Well, thank you, Mr. Klein. Welcome to everybody to Sabbath services. It's good to see you all here. And I want to thank Mr. Stith for the opening or the first message today. We had talked briefly last week about what we were going to talk about, and it sounded like it was going to be opposite things. He was here and I was here, but actually they blend together quite well. Too well. You took some of my scriptures, but well, today is a special day. I don't know if you knew that. It's a day that honors me, and along with a large number of people in the room here, because today is National Middle Child Day. No, maybe you didn't know about it. Maybe you forgot about it, and well, we're used to that. That's all right. But actually, I wasn't aware that there was such a thing until I just saw it recently in the paper, and I thought I would look into it a little bit more and maybe tie a message to it in some way. Well, what is a middle child? I think it's pretty obvious. A middle child is someone who's born in between two or more siblings. And being born in the middle isn't that simple. And you can find a lot of information on the internet. You can find something to support whatever preconceived notion you may have about middle children, that they don't get much attention. They're usually considered outcasts in their family. And they often develop a condition called middle child syndrome. So we've got our own syndrome even. Never hear about that for the oldest and the youngest, but this syndrome, some of the things they say about it is that middle children have feelings of emptiness and inadequacy and jealousy, low self-esteem, extreme introversion, and it goes on and on. I was going to look for some kind of a joke about middle children, and I couldn't find anything, but I did find this one quote that I kind of liked. It said, "Sorry we can't be with you on Middle Child's Day. We're having dinner with your brother and sister." Just a little, yeah. Like I say, we're used to it. So, well, there are messages, too, about middle children dealing with the effects of this so-called middle child syndrome. You can find various statistics about middle children. Something from Psychology Today said, if middles are so resentful and bitter, why are they more cooperative and trusting in their friendships? And why are they such successful leaders? 52% of our presidents have been middles. 52 of the presidents have been middle children. Now, if you want to slant those statistics, there's another quote from a site called www.singleparentscenter.net. And that site says, research has shown that most of the U.S. presidents were either the firstborn or the firstborn son in a family. So we have one statistic that says 52% are middle children. Another one that says most of the presidents were either firstborn or firstborn son. So apparently if you're a middle child but your older sibling is the opposite sex as you are, that might make a difference too. But what are some of the symptoms of middle child syndrome? I mentioned some of them, and you can find a number of what people claim are. Lack of belonging, no sense of direction, trust issues. But something that seems common to all these lists is low self-esteem and maybe a lack of self-confidence. So that is what I wanted to take this message, the direction I wanted to take this message to. I've noticed that this lack of self-confidence and some low self-esteem in my own life from time to time. I don't think the fact that I'm a middle child has anything to do with that. I think everyone regardless of their birth order, probably feels it from time to time. But I'll be looking at the subject of self-confidence, noting the examples of its presence or absence in the Bible and in our own lives even. I'll also cover a few points about developing self-confidence, or at least to the point of convincing others that you have it, even though you may not think you do yourself. The title of this message is Right in the Middle with Confidence. Right in the Middle with Confidence. We'll start with some biblical examples. As I mentioned, the self-confidence or the lack of it isn't limited to middle children, but it's commonly shared among many others as well. And in the Bible, there are a couple of examples that stick out showing a lack of self-confidence. And both of these are ones that Tony kind of skimmed over. I'll go into them in a little more detail. First of all, the example of Moses. And if we look in Exodus, you can turn there if you wish, or otherwise just note the references. In Exodus 2, it talks about the birth of Moses. In verses 1 through 4, it says, "And a man of the house of Levi went and took his wife, a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark and bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him." So we have the birth of Moses. He's a Levite. And it talks about his sister. She was obviously several years older than Moses was. And we see also in Exodus 7:7, it says, "And Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh." So Moses' brother Aaron was also older than him. He was 3 years older than Moses. And Moses, at least among the three, wasn't the middle child, but that doesn't make any difference. Moses' situation was pretty special anyway. He did not have what we'd refer to as a normal upbringing with his family. In Exodus 3, starting in verse 9, this is where God is calling Moses to lead his people out of Egypt. He starts out in verse 9, God is speaking. He says, "Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So Moses wasn't the type of person who jumps in with both feet right away and say, "Let's get going." Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He apparently didn't have the self-confidence to just jump in and do this. He had to be persuaded to do it. And God told him that he would be with him. But Moses still wasn't going to accept that. In verse 13, then Moses said to God, "Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am." But jumping down to Exodus 4, verse 1, then Moses answered and said, "But suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" And again, God gave him a sign with a rod that could become a serpent. Moses just did not want to do this. But God kept working with him. In verse 10, then Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. saying, I'm just not the person to do this. He had every argument he could think of. He was trying to talk God out of this. But God said, well, who has made man's mouth, or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, the blind? And in verse 13, Moses just says, comes down to what he really wanted to say all along, but he said, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Just pick someone else. I'm not the person to do this. And Moses, or God says that he will let Aaron do the speaking for him. So Moses finally, somewhat reluctantly, or very reluctantly, accepted the position. And during the journey to the Promised Land, we find a change in Moses. Moses achieved some successes along the way. He saw the power of God and the things that God could do. He saw the plagues. He saw how the Red Sea had parted and how the Israelites had been destroyed after that. And time after time, Moses was with them and fighting their battles. And finally, Moses had developed enough confidence to plead with God to spare the nation when God was ready to destroy them and start over. And that's in Exodus 32, verses 9 through 14. The Lord said to Moses, I've seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. I will make of you a great nation. God was ready to call it quits with these people. They just were not going to obey him. And then Moses had to persuade God not to. He said, what are the Egyptians going to say if God brought us out into the wilderness just to destroy us? And I suppose Moses, too, was a little leery of God saying that he was going to make a great nation out of Moses himself. That's probably something Moses didn't want for himself either. But Moses persuaded God, and it says he relented from the harm he said he would do to his people. So Moses took some persuading, but he jumped in and he did what God asked him to do. And we can see that he was ultimately successful at it, or as successful as any man could be. And in the end, he was extolled as being a great leader. In Deuteronomy 34, verses 9 and 10, we'll mention in verse 7 of Deuteronomy 34, Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor diminished. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended. And then in verse 9 and 10, what I really want is verses 10 through 12, Deuteronomy 34, 10 through 12. But since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. In all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt before Pharaoh, before all his servants, and in all his land, by all the mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. So Moses lacked self-confidence initially, or had other reasons why he did not want to do that. But God worked with him, and he became a great leader. Such a great leader that it says there was none other like him after that. Another example, which Tony also mentioned, was King Saul. King Saul was also a reluctant leader, a reluctant king, apparently, anyway. In 1 Samuel 10, we read about him. 1 Samuel 10, verse 20. Now, this is where they're choosing who the king is going to be. In verse 20 of 1 Samuel 10, and when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri, was chosen, and Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. So Saul could see this narrowing down by tribe and by family. And eventually this individual family and down to him being chosen. But it says, but when they sought him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, has the man come here yet? And the Lord answered, there he is, hidden among the equipment. He was hiding. He just didn't want to do it. So it says they ran and brought him there. When he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen, that there is no one like him among all the people? So the people shouted and said, long live the king. So he became a reluctant leader. He certainly had the stature for one. He was a person who stood out in a crowd, and I think just in, literally, people had to look up to him. But he became a leader. Now, a third example, also mentioned in the first message, is that of Esther. Now, this is a positive example. We saw two people who were rather reluctant and showed a lack of self-confidence. Esther had something she had to do, and she did it. And we can go through her story in Esther 2, Esther chapter 2, starting in verse 5. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. And it says that Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And going on into the last part of verse 8, it says, Esther was taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of women. And now the young woman pleased him, pleased the king, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. And it says in verse 10 that Esther had not revealed to the king that she was a Jew, because her uncle Mordecai had told her not to say anything about that. Well, Esther continued to gain favor. In the end of verse 15, it says Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. And in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. And it says he made her queen instead of Vashti. So this was a woman who came from humble beginnings, and just by chance, circumstances, and certainly by God's will, she wound up being the queen. In chapter 3, we read about a man named Haman who was plotting a conspiracy against the Jews because he was jealous that they would not bow down to him, so he wanted to destroy all of them. He said Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. And in verse 4 of Esther 4, Esther heard about this. It says Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, and Hathach explained the situation, what was going on there, and what this man was planning against the Jews. So Esther knew she had to do something. In verse 13 of Esther 4, it says, see, it says, they told Mordecai Esther's words. Well, it says, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther. Esther is explaining the situation. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than other Jews. They're saying to her, look, you're in it just as much as all the rest of us are, and you have to do something. If you don't, you are going to be destroyed along with all of us. In verse 14, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? They're saying, just consider that maybe God brought you to this point specifically for this purpose, so that you could save your people. Was Esther afraid? I would certainly think she would be. Her life was at stake. She didn't know how the king would react, and she must have felt that as difficult as this situation was, she had to do it, because she knew that if she went up there and the king wouldn't recognize her and allow her to come in by command, she would be killed anyway. So what did she do? We read in verses 15 through 17 that she sought counsel, she called on God, and she fasted. She asked all of her people to fast also. And we know from reading the rest of the book that things worked out well because of her actions. It's good to know that Esther did what she could to face the situation she was in. She didn't run from it. She had to do something. And she involved God and involved others. And that's good advice for us, too. When we're feeling like we're facing an impossible situation, like we don't have the self-confidence to do what needs to be done, we need to work it out with God. There are many scriptures that we can turn to for encouragement, hope, and assurance of God's presence with us. I have six scriptures that I'm just going to read through. If you want to just write them down, you don't need to turn to them, or maybe you know them from memory. In the Old Testament, two scriptures. First, in Joshua chapter 1, verse 9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. We can't run away from God. He's there with us always. Another scripture from the Old Testament in 2 Kings 6. In verses 14 through 18, the king of Syria is looking for Elisha because he wants to kill him. In verse 14, 2 Kings 6, therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there. This is the king of Syria. And they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God, that's Elisha, Elisha's servant, arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. He looked out there and he saw this vast army, all these horses, all these chariots that were surrounding them. And his servant obviously was afraid. He was worried. He says, and his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? So he answered, Elisha answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. Behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. God had an even bigger army that was going to help them fight this other force. So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And they basically were all confused and were very ineffective. So the point in there is in verse 16, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. I find that to be very encouraging too. And in the New Testament, four scriptures from the New Testament, Acts 18, verses 9 through 11, Paul is in Corinth and said, now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid, but speak and do not keep silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you. For I have many people in this city. And that's the point of the verse I want to emphasize. I have many people in this city. God has many people in this city. And I like to think that wherever I am, God has people around all over the world. And as we heard recently in prayer requests, God has people in Malawi and in Zambia, other places. We heard about a deacon from Malawi, Alfred Mitomoni, who had esophageal cancer and needed to go to Zambia for treatment because he couldn't get it in Malawi. And in the middle of July, we heard that they went on a bus to Zambia, and they were taken in by the pastor there, Major Nawatalami, and his family. And he went and he got the initial treatment that he received. And then there was an update yesterday that said that he had returned safely back to Malawi and will continue his follow-up treatments there. So God is with them, even in what we think of as very remote places. I have many people in this city. Another scripture, 1 Corinthians 2, verses 3 through 5. 1 Corinthians 2, 3 through 5. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Our faith should be in the power of God, not in the wisdom of men. And the last two scriptures are from Philippians 1:6. He who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Familiar scriptures. But what else can we do? What else can we do to build up our self-confidence? Well, if you run a simple search, I ran a search on how to build self-confidence, and it returned about 3.7 million results. And after diligently going through those, I condensed it down to 4 points. And that's a pretty good compression ratio, I think. But the 4 points that seem to be mentioned a number of times are, first of all, no negativity. Stay away from negativity and negative thinkings. Don't dwell on your failures or your shortcomings. Work around them. The second point is, likewise, be positive. Don't just be negative. Don't just not be negative, but be positive. Look at what you've already achieved and think of things that you're good at. Talk yourself up. And I might add, talk up others also. If you see good in other people, let them know. It'll make them feel good. It'll make you feel good too. The third point is take action and face your fear. We saw that in the examples that I mentioned of Moses and King Saul and Esther. They all took action. So that's the third point. Take action and face your fear. There's a quote from William Jennings Bryan that says, the way to develop self-confidence is to do the thing you fear. And quite often you'll find that you had just overbuilt this in your mind. It isn't the big fearful thing you thought it would be. It's just something you can find a way through and work around. And besides those 4 points, there's another aspect to consider. And this was mentioned to me a few years ago by someone, and he was quoting from something that he had heard. And so I looked up the source of this quotation, and I found that it was from a man named Leonard Ravenhill. And according to Wikipedia, Leonard Ravenhill was an English Christian evangelist and author who focused on the subjects of prayer and revival and he lived from 1907 to 1994. And the quote is this: "There are three persons living in each of us, the one we think we are, the one other people think we are, and the one God knows we are." Three persons. Maybe you've heard that quote before. So the person we think we are isn't the person other people see. They see something different. And God sees the real us. And I ran into an example of this at work several years ago. I had been at an obligatory HR meeting that we had to go to from time to time, and several others were there. Among other things, we had talked about some personal goals, and I mentioned to one other person in there, he said, I said I wanted to go to Egypt sometime. And then sometime after that, I ran into this person again, and I was talking to him. He was the manager of our desktop support group, and he had been there. I told him that I was planning to go to Egypt that fall. I knew I'd mentioned that goal to him before. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, I'd like to do that too sometime, but I just don't see it happening." And then he looked at me and said, "You're brave." And I was kind of taken aback by that, because I didn't see that or sense that or feel that in myself at all. But it made me feel good that he had said that. And it made me realize that others may see a different person in me than I see in myself. That's important to consider. Others look at us and they see qualities in us that we may not recognize. They don't usually try to dwell on all of our failures. They're too busy thinking about their own failures, it seems. What he saw as bravery, I saw in another way, maybe naivety or foolishness or unwarranted trust in others, maybe taking risks that I shouldn't, but it's just something that I felt quite comfortable going ahead with, and it turned out just fine. When I first started traveling, I'll just mention this briefly. I was 21. I was in college. I had never been out of the country before, other than crossing the border in Canada. And I had friends in college who had taken trips to Europe the year before that. And I said, "I want to do that." So I talked to my parents about it. I said, "I want to go to Europe for 2 months." And first of all, this was the first time I'd been overseas. First time I'd traveled alone. First time I'd even been on an airplane. And what I had, they agreed to it. What I had was a return airline ticket. I had a Eurail train pass that was good for 2 months. I had approximately $500 in cash and traveler's checks. I had a contact in Vienna. My German professor was teaching in Vienna. So I had a place I could go. Now, if you look at a map, Vienna is probably at the most extreme eastern part of Western Europe you could go to. It's not a handy place to get to, but just knowing he was there was comfort. And I also had a book that I trusted in, Europe on $5 a day. I was sure hoping I could do it on five, and actually I wound up doing it on about $7 a day. You can, at the time, you could find $3 motels or hotels. I showed this book. I happened to be staying in a private home in Oslo, and I showed it to the lady there, and she looked at the part on Oslo and some of the places it recommended staying, and she said, "What? I'd never stay there. That place is terrible. That's a very bad part of town to be in." But I did stay in some places I would not go back to. But anyway, I went, and I don't feel like I was the brave one. I think my parents were the brave ones for letting me go, because I don't think they knew what I knew when I was going there. Well, I am a firm believer in telling people what you're going to say, then saying it, and tell them what you said. So I've done the first point, 2 points. I'll tell you what I said. In this message, I talked about National Middle Child Day, and the lack of self-confidence or low self-esteem that some middle children may have, or others may feel it too, likely do. I talked about biblical examples of self-confidence by Moses and King Saul, both lacking in it, and the positive example of Esther, how she handled her situation. I mentioned 6 scriptural references to provide encouragement and boost our confidence, and they were Joshua 1:9, 2 Kings 6:14 through 18, Acts 18, verse 9 through 11, 1 Corinthians 2:3 through 5, Philippians 1:6, Philippians 4:13. And then I mentioned 4 action steps that we can take to avoid negativity, to be positive, to take action, face your fears, and to get to know who you are and what you want out of life. I talked about the 3 persons living in each of us and gave a personal example. Now, it's natural from time to time to see a lack of self-confidence in ourselves. And even if you are a middle child, though, don't accept it as being inevitable and non-correctable. God is with us. He knows who we really are and what we are capable of doing or becoming. He gives us plenty of assurance that he is involved in our lives and will complete the work that he has begun in us. And there is a 4th step after telling them what you said, and that is sit down.